This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending 22nd of January 2016. Hello and welcome to the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper with extracts from the Hampshire Chronicle for the week ending the 22nd of January, which this week have been edited by Sue Frayne and Linda Vincent. Your readers today are Norma York.
Hello.
Graham Cranmer.
Hello.
And Albie Minns.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Keith Vincent. The main headlines this week: row over Silver Hill axe threat, DNA evidence comes to light, and jobs bonanza on station site. Norman, may we have the story behind the first headline, please?
Certainly. So, row over Silver Hill axe threat. Civic leaders have vowed to drop the Silver Hill developer unless they start the regeneration within weeks. The move has sparked a war of words with the firm and raised the prospect of Winchester City Council relaunching the £150 million scheme alone. TH Real Estate has been told to go ahead with plans for the city centre, including bus station and 100 affordable flats, by February the 9th. Newly released letters show civic chiefs accuse the developer of making untrue and bizarre claims and attempting to confuse councillors over key decisions. Three, spelled T-H-R-E, the initials, formerly known as Henderson's, U-turn on its promise to start work by Christmas, asking the authorities for more time and the chance to change its proposals again. But the Cabinet pledged last week to end the developer's contract if the regeneration doesn't go ahead by February the 9th. Under the terms of the deal, Three would then have another 20 working days to put projects through before they're dropped for good in March. Council chiefs have started planning for life without a development partner, warning that there is complete absence of other builders willing to take on the scheme. Leader Councillor Stephen Godfrey told the Overview and Scrutiny Committee on Monday, "Despite protestations to the contrary, there has not been a series of other people wanting to break down our door to take on the development of Silver Hill. In fact, there is a shortage, a complete absence of others. I think it would be very difficult. However, the situation is that the majority of the land will be owned by three entities, ourselves, Henderson's and Stagecoach. I would expect to find some way of developing it separately, but in tandem, or in some other way which perhaps wouldn't need a development partner, in the same way we're developing Station Approach." The council's row with Three became the public this week as it released previously confidential correspondence with the firm. In a letter delivered through the lawyers, Three said the council had been unreasonable because it misinterpreted the developer's intentions and did not seek clarification from solicitors. Three also suggested it should have been given access to the legal advice behind the council's ultimatum. Leslie Ann Avis, partner at the council's advisers, Berwin Leighton Paisner, branded the request somewhat bizarre. Councillor Godfrey also revealed that on Monday that the council wants to buy St Clement's Surgery in order to rescue its relocation to Upper Brook Street, currently tied up in Silver Hill. However, he added, "There are a lot of reasons why we wouldn't be able to. The owner might not want to sell it to us, but that's what we hope to do." Three cancelled a Chronicle interview with Development Director Martin Perry, scheduled to take place on Monday. Mr Perry said in a statement, "We note the council's decision and will now be considering matters."
DNA evidence comes to light. This is an account of the murder of Georgina Edmonds, who was battered to death in the kitchen of her cottage in Branbridge. And there is a photograph of the cottage and of... A then smiling Georgina Edmonds. New DNA evidence, which prosecutors allege belongs to a Hampshire man currently on trial for a second time, accused of murdering a 77-year-old grandmother, was found 6 years after her death, a court heard. Jurors at Winchester Crown Court were told how police carried out a review of all forensic evidence following the end of the previous trial of Matthew Hamlin in January 2012, when he was acquitted of murder. Another 2 years later, police asked scientists to test tapings from the blouse Georgina Edmonds was wearing when she was battered to death in the kitchen of her cottage in the grounds of Kingfisher Lodge, Kiln Lane, Branbridge. The court heard how in February 2014, those tests found DNA, which the prosecution say is that of 36-year-old Hamlin, who they say carried out the killing. Giving evidence, Detective Inspector Martin Chudley explained how retrieving DNA from tapings on clothing, particularly something that was heavily bloodstained, is deemed difficult and unlikely to yield a result. Initially, that form of testing was carried out on the trousers worn by the pensioner on the day she died, thought to be the most likely to provide evidence, but they failed to return any positive result. At that time, and following that result, a decision was taken not to test the blouse, the court heard. Jurors have also heard of the catalogue of injuries suffered by Mrs. Edmonds on the afternoon of January the 11th, 2008. Prosecutors believe she was beaten across the head with a marble rolling pin from her kitchen. Before she died, she was also repeatedly stabbed across her body in what the court heard was a form of torture by her killer, who wanted her to reveal her cash card PIN. Jurors were told by Home Office pathologist Dr. Hugh White, who carried out the post-mortem, that the pensioner sustained 37 separate wounds across her head, face and body. Giving evidence, he told the court he believed Mrs. Edmonds died from, quotes, a significant blunt force to her head, unquote, while the stab wounds looked like they had been, quote, delivered with some degree of deliberation rather than force, unquote. He told the court how Mrs. Edmonds was wearing a panic button bracelet on her wrist when she died, but it had not been activated. She also showed no defensive marks to her hands, which Dr. White said suggested to him that she'd either been rapidly incapacitated or physically restrained. Hamlin, aged 36, denies murder, and the case is proceeding. And there is a photograph of Matthew Hamlin after his appearance in court, smoking a cigarette.
Jobs bonanza on station site. Five international companies, including a major world player, are in talks over moving to Winchester when its station area is revamped, a meeting heard. Council officials have promised a significant jobs boost if top employers set up in proposed new office blocks. Attracting big business is the cornerstone of the station approach development, which will see two areas near the railway station transformed with commercial space, shops, housing, infrastructure and open space. Kevin Warren, Winchester City Council's head of estates, told Cabinet that the biggest of five firms interested is looking to open a 40,000 square foot head office and could bring another company along, bringing its tenancy to 90,000 square feet. These are very big, important players in the world, Mr. Warren said. They would be a fantastic coup for the city in terms of employment and in terms of the kinds of jobs we would like to see in the city, a broad range from low level to high level. It would be very, very beneficial for the local economy if we were able to secure these companies. Mr. Warren described one business as in the financial world, but would not divulge further details when approached by the Chronicle. The news came as a second architect pulled out of the competition to design the scheme. London-based Grimshaw Architects quit last week, leaving three firms in the mix. Field & Clegg Bradley Studios had already backed out to pursue another project. Winchester's design engine, Aedas RHWL, and Hopkins Architects Partnership now make up the shortlist. Design engine last week secured a contract to design a master plan for the £125 million new campus at London Metropolitan University. But founder director Rod Graham reaffirmed his commitment to station approach when approached by the Chronicle. Councillor Stephen Godfrey, leader of Winchester City Council, said the three remaining architects were the council's top choices when the shortlist was compiled. He told the meeting, "We have three of the best companies on our shortlist, still wanting to develop in Winchester, who will bring forward and design really exciting, innovative, sustainable and interesting proposals for Winchester, which will come before a jury in April, before a decision is made in May. The practices are 6 weeks into a 14-week design period. As reported by the Chronicle, architects had raised concerns over the tight time schedule over Christmas. That prompted a 4-week extension by the City Council to allow firms more time to submit their designs. Councillor Godfrey said it would be unfair to start again in order to recruit other firms, but some Winchester practices were upset at missing out on the initial shortlist. Asked about the dropouts, Paul Bulkley, Design Director of Snug Architects, said they had been made aware of the extension. They may have had time to complete their bid. Mr. Bulkley said, "If we had been informed a few weeks ago, then we might have had time to compete, but it is clearly too late now." And there are photographs. One of Kevin Warren, head of estates, looking very pleased at what had been achieved so far. Another of the station approach development site in Winchester. And another of Design Engine, with Rod Graham, Richard Jobson and Richard Rose Casemore standing outside the door.
Thank you. That concludes the headlines. Now we continue with the death announcements, followed by Christian comment, letters, historical items, editorial comment, first person and Belgarum. So we start with the death announcements for this week. Born, Erica Christina Harley Born, who died suddenly but peacefully at a nursing home in Winchester, aged 86. Gervois, John Lovies Gervois, known as Jack, died peacefully at home, aged 80. Legg, Olga Legg, died on the 12th of January in Birmingham, aged 95. Pipon, or Pipon, P-I-P-O-N, Michael James Pipon, died peacefully on the 12th of January, aged 83. Ross, Malcolm Paul Ross, died peacefully on the 13th of January, aged 56. Walsh, Anne Walsh, died peacefully at the Countess of Brecknock Hospice, aged 59. Westwell, Gillian Westwell, died peacefully at home, aged 84. And Wright, Marjorie Wright, died at the Countess Mountbatten Hospice, aged 87. And now we move on to letters to the... Christian Comment. Albie, thank you.
Yes, Christian Comment this week. Church faces up to contentious issues. Last week, the leaders of the Anglican Communion met to discuss homosexuality and to explore whether there could be agreement on this contentious issue across the Anglican churches of the world. The debate reflected the reality that gender issues are dealt with very differently in local cultures where the church is represented. 12 years ago in the USA, the first openly gay bishop was ordained, and since then gay and lesbian marriage has been celebrated in that church. In contrast, in much of Africa, homosexuality is illegal, and in Uganda, it can lead to life in jail. It's no wonder that Christians in these very different contexts discern that God is leading them to different conclusions. The differences are also seen in local settings, with the legislation to allow civil gay marriage in this country causing both joy and dismay in the church. Anglicanism's tension is seen in the declaration of assent at ordination on accepting a Church of England post. It refers to the historic faith which we are to proclaim afresh in each generation. Unfortunately, there is little agreement on what of this historic faith is true for all time and what is open to reinterpretation. So in 1988, the Anglican Communion met and was worried by moves in the American church to ordain a woman bishop, a change now widely celebrated. The same is true in allowing the remarriage of divorcees in church, at one time rejected, but now widely accepted, in a move which celebrates the opportunity to reflect God's love. The Bible encourages change in our understanding of faith. Jesus says to his disciples, "When the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth." We are constantly being led by the Holy Spirit into all truth, realizing that both tradition and our present understanding of God's will are incomplete. This has always been the case and is reflected in our Anglican heritage by the work of William Tyndale, who translated the Bible into English so that a ploughboy would understand it. Not only did the ploughboys of England understand the Bible, but they also questioned their long-standing tradition in the light of this understanding. The majority of the Anglican leaders upheld the traditional view of marriage and said, "Marriage is a lifelong union between a man and a woman." This has led to the American church being suspended from some committees for 3 years. At the same time, all the leaders are committed to walking together. No local church is to be excluded, and the unity for which Jesus prayed is upheld. Diversity has always been part of our Christian history, as seen by Paul having a dig at Peter in his biblical letters. We often struggle with diversity, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, apologised for the hurt and pain inflicted upon gay and lesbian people by the church, showing the conflicting emotions which this meeting brought. Contentious issues are here to stay, and Christians will wrestle to understand God's will, reflecting both the God who is love and the love of our brothers and sisters. And that is written by the Reverend Paul Kennedy.
Thank you. Now we move on to letters to the editor. There are six letters. The first two, perhaps not very surprisingly, relate to Silver Hill. Norma.
Back to square one. Sir, it will not surprise you that I write yet again about the redevelopment of Silver Hill. Many could well believe that the scheme is ever controversial, given that it has dragged on for what seems like eternity. 20 years down the line, we have a collective responsibility to answer the question Duncan Gezid poses, Silver Hill, what now? Councillor Godfrey is correct in saying that, in inverted commas, we have to protect the interests of Winchester. He has also stated that he would like to move forward with the current scheme if at all possible. Quite obviously, the scheme is not possible. It's outmoded, outdated, and totally inappropriate. If TH Real Estate needs months and months to offer a scheme of acceptable quality, the conclusion must be that the current scheme is unacceptable. Underlying the whole issue is the need to achieve consensus on the purpose of the redevelopment of Silver Hill, as of other major projects such as Station Approach. A coherent vision is required, underpinned by an informed analysis of factors that attract people to live and work in Winchester and to visit the city. First and foremost must be its historic character. All future development must be sensitive to that heritage. Secondly, we need to extend provision for Winchester to enhance its cultural reputation, to enable it to become a centre of excellence. Some city councillors are reported to fear that Winchester will be left behind as a shopping destination. During the last 20 years, the nature of shopping has changed dramatically. Local residents and visitors alike seek out small, individual and independent shops, ones which offer a different range of products from the chain stores. Ironically, the proprietors of such businesses currently see their future in Winchester threatened by an escalating rates and rents, a congested high street and progressively poorer access to the city as car parks are shut. The council must be resolute, steadfast and firm at this critical point. There is one simple answer to Silver Hill, what now? Back to the drawing boards. And that's by Una Stevens of Cliffway, Compton Down, Winchester.
And this letter is by Karen Barrett. Sir, I'm beginning to wonder whether any of us will live long enough to see Silver Hill featured in your From the Files section rather than front page news yet again. See Chronicle, January the 14th. We are now being teased by Winchester City Council at the brink of making a decision to draw a line under the whole sorry saga. They're not always so indecisive. Recently, they made two senior officers redundant. The logic of this decision escaped me, especially as I had a clear idea of what the professionals in question actually did, which is not always the case with other officers still in post. Surely such a significant reorganisation would have been better left until after the Claire Lloyd-Jones report into the Silver Hill process. Where THRE Henderson is concerned, however, the council seems to have great difficulty in making the break. It's now over a year since Tories and Lib Dems on the planning committee ignored protests and agreed to Henderson's amended scheme for Silver Hill, which removed social housing and the bus station. Independent legal action was required to throw that out. THRE continues to challenge that decision in the Court of Appeal, while simultaneously coming up with reasons to make similar fundamental changes to the original approved scheme. It seems obvious to many of us that THRE is only interested in providing what suits them, regardless of the requirements of Winchester residents. In another report on the housing budget in last year's paper, you quoted Councillor Martin Todd as saying, "We mustn't be seen as a soft touch for developers. It's the last chance for the council to make this aspiration a reality." Karen Barrett, Byron Avenue, Full Flood, Winchester.
And now two letters that do not mention Silver Hill. David Selby of West Hill Road North, South Wanstrom, writes under the heading Devolution Debate, "Sir,
I was interested to read what I think may be your most extensive article on the process of devolution that is currently and quietly being negotiated between Hampshire, Portsmouth, Southampton and the Isle of Wight and the government. This devolved area would have a population of nearly 2 million and would include a major part of South Coast industry. Next door, we have Dorset, population 400,000 approximately, with a large tourist industry, and Wiltshire, population 500,000 approximately, which is heavily agricultural. How are they going to fare alongside this proposed giant? If the government is serious about devolution as a nationwide policy, it needs to be a little more ambitious and inclusive, so that there is a balance within each devolved area of richer and less affluent counties. At Berkshire, population 900,000 approximately, and Oxfordshire, population 700,000 approximately, and we would have a devolved area with a population of approximately 4 million, something more in line with existing devolved areas. More power could be given to district authorities and parish councils, devolving it closer to the people. County councils could be abolished, saving the cost of a whole tier of administration, and a Wessex Parliament could maintain a strategic role over national concerns such as health, education and transport, which the districts would administer. I feel it is somewhat ironic that the last major reorganisation of local government was carried out in 1974 by the Heath administration, and one of its main aims was to reduce the size of some counties, which included Hampshire. Devolution will affect you, dear reader, so why not join in the discussion before it is set in concrete and presented as a done deal? I've offered you my thoughts. What about yours?
Not so affordable. Sir, there has been a lot said about affordable housing. The phrase affordable housing is chucked about like a political hot potato. The impression is given that it cures all ills in the housing sector. Unfortunately, affordable housing in the south of the country, is not affordable to its core target population. I support a review of the social housing sector. Then tenants and members of housing trusts and associations and the taxpayer get a fairer deal. The present system is too complicated and bureaucratic. Council tenants and housing trust and association members should have the right to buy 100% of their property. Surely it is better to give families a healthy subsidy to enable them to purchase. It means that some will not be reliant long-term on benefit system, and hopefully this will benefit future generations. I also understand the need of councils to retain housing stock for rent, and a change in government policy should make this feasible. I have reservations about the housing trusts and associations and the schemes they operate. Members are not allowed to buy any or 100% of their homes, and the rents they charge are set at about 30% above council house rents. They hide behind charitable status and tell us that they are reinvesting in the housing stock. The vast majority of their income goes in administering themselves, which includes generous salaries. It is as though an unnecessary income stream has been introduced into the social housing sector, and we, the taxpayer, are paying twice, as we are already funding councils to provide these services. I watched a local scheme developed jointly by WCC and Winchester Housing Trust from the start. It struck me that all the advantages of free land have been lost in a sea of bureaucrats and red tape, resulting in the absurdity that a 2 or 3 bedroom houses can be bought in our parish for less than the overall value of the affordable homes. A great opportunity has been lost. Planners and developers must start from the basis of what people can afford and think outside the box. And that was from Mr. T.I. Martin, Diva Close, Mitchell Dever.
This letter is from Rachel Curtis, who's the Secretary of the PCC. We have a dilemma in Kilmerston, in that our churchyard is almost full. We were donated a new piece of land about 12 years ago, but could not use the land without having planning permission and an archaeological investigation. This was done in 2014 at a cost of £3,000, thanks to kind donations from villagers and a grant from the Friends of St Andrews. Two trenches were dug, where indicated by WCC, and finds included some pottery sherds, flint flakes, fragments of mammal bones from iron smithing slag. Charcoal and small pieces of building material, probably relating to the rebuilding of the church in about 1774, were also found. The villagers were interested in the finds, but they did not seem very important and certainly will never be displayed in a museum. Planning permission was then sought and was granted, subject to our doing more archaeological work, a requirement of WCC's archaeologist, who considered there might be more items of interest to be found. Unfortunately, this extra work has been costed at £24,000, which is too much for the PCC to raise easily, and so we appealed this decision, using an eminent independent archaeologist's opinion that the archaeological findings were, quotes, the sort of thing you might find in any field in Hampshire, unquote. Our appeal has failed. What does the PCC do now? Are a few archaeological artefacts more important than the needs of Kilmerston parishioners to be buried in their own churchyard? Should we apply for grants and try to fundraise this extra amount? Or try to use a group of archaeological volunteers, vetoed by WCC originally? Or just leave the land as it is, install a bench and use the area for rest, recreation and contemplation for villagers and walkers? The PCC are volunteers trying to do their best for their community. This saga has already been going on for ages, and the members of the PCC may well be dead and, unfortunately not, buried before this matter is ever resolved. It will be interesting to know the opinion of other people in the area about the importance of history over local needs. Rachel Curtis, PCC Secretary, St Andrew's Church, Kilmerston.
Catherine Turness, Executive Director of Winchester Business Improvement District, BID, writes, "Sir, recently you have reported on the Christmas congestion created by the city centre market and lack of parking. And in particular, I would like to address the concerns raised in your article last week, Traders' City Centre Fears. As Executive Director of Winchester Business Improvement District, BID, I am writing to confirm and reassure BID levy-paying businesses, especially, that we deliver more than marketing and promotion and are acting upon the feedback we have received. We are vigorously lobbying Winchester City Council to take action so we do not repeat the chaos of Christmas 2015. At a meeting last week, Economic Portfolio Holder Councillor Burns confirmed senior conversations are taking place within the council, which has resulted in confirmation of a review of the location and frequency of the market throughout the year. Since then, I can confirm that Council Cabinet will receive a paper on March 29th on this matter, and we are continuing to gather evidence to support the views of businesses. The BID is not against having a market in the city. Markets can contribute to the prosperity and cultural attraction of an area, but it should not be at the expense of existing traders who pay extremely high rates and rent to trade in the city's prime location. On parking, we welcome the mid-term review proposed by Councillor Burns and shall respond to the consultation as the issue is likely to be exacerbated by the closure of Chesil Flat Surface Car Park and the proposed surgery development on Upper Brook Street. The BID is a voice for over 760 businesses, and thus we have a number of views to balance. But while we're only too pleased to hear of business groups forming, we already attend meetings of successfully formed groups, and we would encourage businesses to work together with the BID to deliver a prosperous trading environment. More than just marketing and promotion, we're here to assist BID levy payers to ensure Winchester is attractive for their service users and staff, which includes lobbying amongst delivering over 80 other projects and services.
Thank you. That concludes the letters. And now we move on to historical items. We're going to step back in time, a couple of hundred years to start with. Norma.
200 years ago, January the 22nd, 1816. There's three items here. Gala occasion. Winchester. The second subscription vocal concert took place on Monday evening at St John's House in this city. It was honoured by the presence of numerous and elegant audience who bore ample testimony to the excellence of the performance. The whole was judiciously arranged and admirably executed. The concert was succeeded by a ball. Dancing was continued until a late hour, and the company separated, highly gratified with the evening's amusement. The next item is Regency Lovies, London. After the admirable performance of Mr. Keane on Friday last at Drury Lane Theatre, in the character of Sir Giles Overreach, which made so strong an impression on the actors as well as the audience, his brother performers resolved to present him with a gold cup in testimony of their admiration of his talents as an actor and their esteem for his character as a man. A subscription was immediately entered into, to which Lord Byron contributed 25 guineas. The subscription exceeds £200. And the third item. The park and tower guns were fired on Thursday in honour of the Queen's birthday. Her Majesty entered upon the 72nd year of her age. I think that was Victoria.
Wrong year, I think, that one.
This is 100 years ago, January the 22nd, 1916, two items. The first headed Scouts on Leave from Bishop Swaltham. Patrol leaders Millard and Spratt and Corp, I suppose it's Corporal, never heard of that as a scout rank, Blover, have recently been home on 3 days leave. The Bishop Swaltham troop have now four scouts on the coast watching duty at HM Coast Guard Station at Bournemouth, patrol leader Chapel having recently joined. There is still a vacancy for one more scout at the above station, and any scout from the local or district troops wishing to go on coast watching duty should give his name to the scoutmaster, Mr. Robin Gunner, without delay. And the second one is headed World War One Health Visitors. There is a branch of work connected with the Public Health Department which the local government board terms the Winchester Municipal Maternity Centre. The health visitor, Mrs. A. Poulton, calls on all suitable mothers who may be notified as soon as the doctor or midwife leaves and gives advice. On Wednesday afternoons, meetings are held at the Guildhall when mothers bring their babies for weighing or measuring and are given advice on feeding or the general management of infants. A small prize, a post office savings bank book opened with a deposit of 5 shillings, was given to the baby making the most regular attendances in the past year.
50 years old. Two items. January 22nd, 1966. Art school born. Winchester. Bordered by the bustling thoroughfare of North Walls on one side and the uninspiring wastes of Winnell Marshes on the other, the new £320,000 Winchester School of Art is a mere shell, no more. It has come to life in a way which could in time make it one of the major cultural centres in Hampshire. Although construction workers are still engaged on completion of the project, equally busy are over 100 students drawn from all over the country who are already studying textiles, design, painting, sculpture, lithography, illustration and other subjects. And the second item, Forgotten Railway. The announcement this week that the southern region of British Rail have plans to spend nearly £500,000 to improve commuter services into London must be good news, especially to those using the congested southeastern lines from Kent, East Sussex and the South London suburbs. At a press conference proclaiming these plans on Tuesday, however, not a single mention was made of a stretch of railway that seems to be becoming Hampshire's forgotten line. Inquiries revealed no definite plans for the future of the Alton-Winchester line, which passes through Medstead, Ropley, Ulsford and Itchen Abbas, before joining the main Waterloo-Bournemouth line at Winchester Junction.
And 25 years ago, on January the 18th, 1891, Gulf War starts. 9 hours after hostilities broke out in the Gulf, people in Winchester gave their views on the decision to go to war. Mrs. Marion Parton of Winchester stated, "I don't like to see them go to war. I don't agree with it. They could have waited a little longer before starting the attack." Stuart Thorne of Waltham Chase said the decision was brilliant, adding, "Saddam Hussein has got to be stopped, otherwise it will get worse later on." John Phipps from Alsford said, "I think it's a regrettable necessity." And the second item, easier births. The Winchester Resuscitaire, an innovative piece of maternity equipment which prevents a mother having to be moved during labour, is being sponsored by a weak man who himself was a premature baby. Ken Henderson, now 27, of Trussell Crescent, is aiming to raise £5,000 to pay for a fourth resuscitaire desperately needed by the labour ward at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital. The resuscitaire was pioneered by Miss Pamela Underwood, midwife manager in charge of the labour ward. It's a transportable machine incorporating a heater to keep the baby warm, an oxygen supply and a sucking facility to clear the baby's lungs and mouth. And now we move on to the editorial comment, Norma.
It says Hampshire Chronicle, our 243rd year. Right to put its foot down over proposal. Now, you can only imagine what this is about. Winchester City Council is right to put its foot down over Silver Hill. TH Real Estate, THRE, has a chance to deliver its regeneration it promised for the city centre. Giving it another one when its position changes so regularly would be irresponsible. But the path to the new scheme will be extremely difficult, especially if the council chooses to build without a partner. Acquiring the land and the means to build will be expensive and complicated and time-consuming. There is no guarantee that it will deliver a better project, and the threat of legal action from THRE and and Winchester deserves better campaign goes on. However, taking control of this rundown part of the city would, to some extent, shelter the council from construction industry, which we have learnt can be ruthless. Council-led plans to develop station approach are in their way very early stages, but have so far shown that another way is possible. One cannot discount the possibility of THRE building the scheme now, perhaps realising that it's the only way to keep this lucrative contract. Doing so would raise serious questions about their claims that the plans would fail to meet building standards. But so long as this part of the city centre is restored, Winchester is capable of gritting its teeth through anything. And I only hope that we don't have to wait 243 years to have a resolution of this.
And now we move on to first person, Graham.
First person this week is by George Hayter, and he calls it Building the Way Forward. A housing estate being built on the edge of Winchester has got me thinking about architects. Winchester Village will eventually provide 200 attractive homes. Its medley of materials and historical styles successfully mimics some of the delightful aesthetic muddle of a traditional English village. It started me pondering, who is the most influential architect in this country? These days, space-age British architects like Norman Foster and Richard Rogers dominate world architecture, but little of their jazzy spaces and dazzling technology is to be seen at retro-style Winchester Village. Foster's huge range of iconic projects, ranging from the Gherkin to the Reichstag, and Rogers brought us everything from the cheese grater to the Pompidou Centre. Yet neither of them has influenced contemporary building design as much as a well-known critic who has never trained as an architect. The influence of this 67-year-old can be seen in schemes throughout Hampshire and beyond. If he was in practice, he might call himself Charles Windsor, but we all know him as the Prince of Wales. Despite his lack of any training, the heir to the throne is an architect in all but name, and as significant a figure in our architectural story as 20th century masters Frank Lloyd Wright or Walter Gropius. Charles's interest in architecture is well known. His passion for the subject once led him aloft to join craftsmen precariously restoring the roof of Winchester Cathedral. His championing of classical design led him to found the Prince's Foundation for Building Community. He was one of the first to decry the absence of decoration. It's now 30 years since his condemnation of a modern-style building planned for Trafalgar Square as a monstrous carbuncle on the face of a much-loved friend. About 20 years ago, construction started on a new western suburb of Dorchester, Poundbury will eventually provide 2,200 homes. It's being built on Duchy of Cornwall land and has been designed according to old-fashioned principles defined by the Duke of Cornwall, which is another name for, Prince Charles. His principles were set out in his 1989 book, A Vision of Britain, which argues for planning and building to preserve British architectural traditions and to be on a human scale. You can see the result at Poundbury if you're heading west on the A35. Turn off the Dorchester bypass just west of the town. There, visitors find a multiplicity of styles and materials jammed together in apparent unplanned layout, like a real English village. Tunbury created huge media interest when the project began. Coverage concentrated on his belief that a traditional community which had evolved over centuries elsewhere might be planned and built in just a few years. In Hampshire, the emerging housing estate at Winchester, with its sash windows, classical columns, Georgian symmetry, and mix of brick, stucco, and flint, is basically a copy of Tunbury. There'll be many other copies in every county. Some come close to the convincing charm of Tunbury, others are paler copies. How can Charles be the most influential architect when he isn't an architect? In fact, he is an architect in the same sense that Foster and Rogers are architects. With their huge practices, F&R no longer create the designs that bear their names. Rather, their staff work on their guiding principles, such as the team planning Poundbury has complied with the principles set out in A Vision of Britain. Charles, like Foster and Rogers, is an architect in chief. Winchester Village demonstrates that of the three of them, the architect having most influence on our building environment is Charles.
Thank you. Now we move on. We've got some items from Belgarum, Albie.
Yes, Belgarum, an alternative look at the news with three items. The first under the heading, City's former Lib Dem MP denies rumours. Winchester's disgraced former MP has made a shock return to politics, sort of. Mark Oughton was back in Lib Dem colours earlier this month to offer his services for May's council election. Volunteering to write leaflets and knock on doors, it was the first time in 5 years he had attended a local party meeting, but it appears some got the wrong end of the stick. Rumours reached Belgarum last week that the MP from 1997 to 2010 was plotting to run for City Council, taking the seat of retiring Richard Izzard in Twyford and Coldon Common. But Mr. Oughton flatly denied the claim when approached on Tuesday. "I'm not running for the general election, not running for the local election, not running for a bus, not running for a taxi," he said. "I'm just not in the country enough for it to work." 10 years ago today, Mr. Oughton resigned from the Lib Dem front bench after a tabloid scandal over his affair with a rent boy. Nowadays, he splits his time between Twyford and Brussels, where he is chief executive of the International Fur Trade Federation. And the second item. Now look here. Review row. A row has broken out between a Winchester pub and one of its punters after the landlord claimed that she, that is the punter, put her own hair in a meal. Miriam Dickens wrote a one-star review of the Green Man before Christmas, claiming she found a dark hair in her burger. The Southgate Street joint has barred her after other customers allegedly saw Miss Dickens place the hair herself. The dispute played out on tourist website TripAdvisor in November, but came to Belgarum's attention after Miss Dickens was asked to leave the bar on Saturday. Miss Dickens, an officer at Hampshire County Council, denies placing the hair and says she was absolutely shocked to learn she'd been barred. "To ban me as some job is the worst reaction you could have possibly made in this small and friendly city," she said. Jane Gillin, owner of the Green Man, described her as a troublemaker, while manager Fiona Dykes responded, saying staff were truly saddened and bewildered by the accusation. "There was no person in our kitchen or anyone who had been in contact with your food with dark hair, Miss Dykes said. And the third item, opinion on market fails to impress. It seems Winchester's top councillor is unimpressed with the views of one of its premier jewellers. Jeremy France is among many traders urging a limit on market stalls, claiming they turn off customers. At the recent full council meeting, Councillor Paul Twelvetree asked his administration how it could increase visitor numbers. "Don't listen to Jeremy France," council leader Stephen Godfrey said in the ear of the mayor.
Thank you. Now we have the this week's announcements. We're starting with What's On. And on Saturday the 30th of January, there's a concert in Winchester Cathedral at 7 p.m. A celebration of peace by Hampshire County Youth Orchestra. And it's with special reference to World War One. You can get more details from the Cathedral box office on 01962 857 275. And from Tuesday the 26th to Saturday the 30th of January at the Mayflower, Southampton, the Birmingham Royal Ballet are performing Swan Lake. There are afternoon performances on Thursday and Saturday and evening performances throughout. And the box office is 02380 711 811. The lighting up time ends Friday the 22nd of January at 7:56 a.m. and begins at 4:38 p.m. Next week on Wednesday the 27th of January it ends at 7:50 a.m. and begins at 4:46 p.m. And if you know someone who's sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with the recording you've received from us, please telephone Irene Dowding on 01962 870 370, and her details are on a card inside your wallet. And now we continue with items, further items of general news. Norma.
Teen urging more to foster children. A Hampshire teenager is urging people to consider offering a loving home to children in care after revealing how being adopted transformed her own harrowing early years. Nicole, now 17, recalled terrifying memories of living with her drug-addicted parents, including finding needles hidden in the bread bin, in an essay for a GCSE project. She now wants to share her story to encourage more people to consider adoption. Nicole has shared extracts from her essay to help people understand the difference they can make by adopting a child. Ahead of an information evening held by the charity Digramma in Winchester later this month. The essay focuses on Room 101, into which Nicole chose to banish drugs. She writes, "My birth parents were both addicts. I was only little and I didn't always understand what was happening. But I remember being scared. Drugs were in the house all the time. My brother and I would hide in the cupboards when the fights broke out in the house. There were a lot of fights. Police would search the house looking for drugs, and we would sometimes find needles hidden in a bread bin. Strange people kept coming to the house to take drugs, and it would often end up in chaos. I was terrified. I was taken into care as a result of my parents taking drugs. This made me feel even more uncomfortable and more unsafe. I just wanted to go home, if that's what they call it. I wanted to go, run. However, something inside me told me not to. Soon I found out that my social workers wanted to find a new home for us. As soon as I heard, my heart missed a beat. A new family. That moment I felt safer than I ever had been. A feeling of someone who wanted us. A new start. I felt excited, happy, and sad all at once. Emotions came thundering in one after the other. My new mum and dad. They've helped me become more confident and not scared. To me, living with them now is the safest place on earth. They have brought me up to help me forget my dreadful past living with drugs. Nicole and her parents, Andy and Mary, are now ambassadors for the charity, which specialises in loving homes for vulnerable children, considered harder to place. Mary said, "We adopted Nicole and her brother, Charlie, and we would urge anyone thinking about adopting to find out more. There can be challenges along the way, but the rewards are enormous. We have the family we always dreamt of, and to watch our children flourish and achieve their potential is amazing. They have been through so much in their early lives and just needed a safe, loving home." The charity is campaigning for people across the county to get in touch as soon as possible if they believe they could help a child through a fostering or adoption. They will be holding an information evening at Middlebrook Centre on January the 27th, where people can find out more about the process involved in becoming a foster carer or adopter and learn about the children that need care. The charity's adoption and fostering service offers adopters and carers professional support and training free of charge, as well as therapeutic services to help overcome many challenges.
Councillors have controversially given the green light to proposals to build a 5-megawatt solar plant on farmland near Goodworth Clatford. Councillors on Test Valley Borough Council's Northern Area Planning Committee have granted permission to Teeling Solar Parks to build over 16,000 PV panels on a 12.4-hectare site at Fullerton Farm. The farmland is situated along the A3057 southwest of the Hampshire Golf Club. The solar farm will supply energy to an estimated 1,300 homes. The plan had provoked mixed reaction, with Wirral Parish Council supporting the plans, while councillors in Goodworth Clatford objected, worried about semi-industrialisation of the area, with the site bordering an oil well and a sewage works. Parish councillors were also concerned about the overdevelopment of solar farms in the village, already hosting two sites totalling 46 acres and a 160-acre site awaiting an appeal hearing.
St Cross Star heads to Kent. Kent have signed former Hampshire's second 11 wicketkeeper batsman Adam Rouse, who has been playing ECB Southern Premier League cricket for St Cross Simodians for the past two seasons. The 23-year-old right-hander was born in Zimbabwe and has made five appearances in first-class cricket for Hampshire and Gloucestershire. Rouse played junior cricket for Basingstoke and North Hants before joining the Aegis Bowl Academy. He played for Kent second 11 in 2014 and returned for a month on trial in April 2015 as cover for Sam Billings and could deputise for the England man in 2016 after signing a contract with the club. Kent's new number 12 said, "I'm delighted to be rejoining Kent on a more permanent basis. I really enjoyed my time at the beginning of last year, and hopefully I can use this opportunity to push on and secure myself a regular first team spot. I'm very grateful to the Kent management for showing faith in me and allowing me for this opportunity." He added, "I'm looking forward to getting stuck in. A lot of hard work lies ahead and I'm excited to get going. After my month there last year, I followed Kent's fortunes and there were some excellent white ball performances, so hopefully we can kick on this year and go a step or two further." Rouse hit a match winning 35 not out against Kent for Gloucestershire in the 2014 NatWest T20 Blast, hitting a boundary off the final ball of the match to clinch a 3-wicket win.
Shopping centre joins Main Event, spelt M-A-N-E, and it will all be revealed. The Brook Shopping Centre in Winchester has been revealed as the latest business to go zany for zebras as part of this summer's art spectacular. Zebra sculptures will be dotted around Southampton City Centre later this year as part of Marwell's Wildlife Art event. The zebras, decorated by commercial sponsors, are designed to raise awareness and funds for the endangered grevy zebra, as well as providing family-friendly trails through the summer holidays. Along with the large sculptures, a mini version of the trail will be staged at Marwell Zoo itself. The zoo's first sculpture, Gilbert the Zebra, will be in the Brooks from 10:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. on Saturday to raise the profile of the trial. Animal lovers are invited to take a hashtag selfie with the animal and post it on social media for a chance to win a family day out at Marwell. Liz Marsden, Marketing and Communications Manager at the Brooks, said, "We are delighted to be able to sponsor one of Marwell's zany zebras. It's a fantastic community campaign which supports a great cause, raising money to help conserve these beautiful and endangered grevy zebras. We can't wait to see the Brooks zebra out and about." Businesses and organisations across Hampshire have sponsored their own sculpture and will be decking it out in colours and patterns. Kirsty Matheson, project manager at Marwell, said, "Marwell's zany zebras will raise the profile of all sponsors and partners involved to hundreds and thousands of visitors and residents alike. Exploring not only the trail in Southampton, but the miniature trail in Marwell Zoo too. We are delighted that the Brook Shopping Centre have recognised this opportunity and joined the stampede to sponsor a zebra." And there's a lovely picture of a multicoloured, full-size zebra with Liz Marsden and Kirsty Matheson in the Brook Centre. And his name's Gilbert.
A motorcyclist was rescued by firefighters when he became trapped under a car in a freak crash on a Hampshire road in the early hours. A rider, believed to be in his early 20s, became stuck after his bike was in collision with a Kia car in Romsey Road, Winchester, close to the Royal Hampshire County Hospital. Crews from Winchester Fire Station arrived and used hydraulic lifting equipment to ease the vehicle off the injured man. It took 15 minutes to eventually free him, and he was taken to hospital by ambulance. He suffered serious leg, head and arm injuries and was taken to Southampton General Hospital. The woman driver of the Kia car was unharmed in the collision, and the road was closed in both directions while crews worked following the incident at 12:30 a.m. on Tuesday, January the 19th.
Three items here, three short items. One is an apology by the Chronicle. One is a correction by the Chronicle. Under the first, the apology, there's a photograph of late Paul Chilton, who was killed in a car crash. And the apology reads as follows. "Last week, in a report of the inquest into the death of Paul Chilton in a car crash near Crawley, the Chronicle printed a photograph, not of Mr. Chilton, pictured, but of Alex Wood. Mr. Wood is alive and well, but understandably upset about the mistake. The Chronicle apologises unreservedly for any upset and confusion caused by the error." And then the second item, a correction. In a report from the Winchester City Council Planning Committee about a proposal for two houses in Coldon Common last week, the Chronicle incorrectly attributed comment about the allegedly inadequate site infrastructure to Maggie Hill, Deputy Chairman of the Parish Council, instead of to City Councillor Sue Cook. We also reported the vote to approve the scheme in Spring Lane to have been unanimous, when in fact local member Councillor Richard Izzard abstained. Apologies for any confusion that might have been caused. And the third item, whiskey theft. Stealing a small bottle of whiskey has cost Anthony Mort £110. Mort, 63, of Eastgate Street, Winchester, was caught stealing the whiskey, valued at £6.50, from Sainsbury's in Middlebrook Street on November the 18th. He pleaded guilty and was fined £60, with a £20 victim surcharge and £30 costs.
Drug dealers from London are caught. Police have hammered drug dealing in Winchester, officers say. Five Londoners have been held after using city houses as bases. PCSO Tim Wilde told a meeting. It comes after crack houses in Trussell Crescent, Week and Colston Close, Winnall, were shut via a court order. PCSO Wilde said a vulnerable drug user in Trussell Crescent was being hosted by dealers from the capital who would send runners to deal on the streets. We've made it difficult for it to happen. We've dramatically reduced what's going on, PCSO Donna Biddle told the Police and Communities Together meeting. They are speaking to these people all the time and finding out where they come from. PCSO Wilde said that they also clamped down on a legal high dealer in the city centre. A woman operating from King's Walk Antique Market has stopped selling new psychoactive substances after officers threatened to shut her down. A woman market worker said, "It used to be horrendous. We used to have kids, thousands of them, and we don't anymore." Last month, police closed Head High, a shop selling legal highs in Stockbridge Road. And there is a picture of PCSO Lawrence Day and PC David Brown at the legal high shop in Stockbridge Road last month. And it has a large notice with "closed to protect your neighbourhood from the risk of substance misuse and related antisocial behaviour." And obviously gives a crime number and or phone 101.
The boarding house of Winchester's special school is set to close this summer. Osborne School's dormitories are due to be converted into classrooms, increasing the number of places for older pupils. The move will boost post-16 capacity by around 30, but one parent has said it will seriously diminish some children's chances of living independently as adults. Osborne is the only school of its kind to offer boarding in Hampshire and currently hosts three children. Support packages are being prepared for parents, according to Hampshire County Council, and head teacher Sonia O'Donnell hopes to protect most jobs if the plans, expected to go out to public consultation tomorrow, go ahead. The refit is designed to help youngsters with severe learning difficulties who cannot access local colleges. Osborne House has never filled its 10 beds and is not fit for purpose, according to council officers, who said last night that money would be better allocated for post-16 pupils. Objecting to the proposals, one parent, who was not named, said, "I've no idea where our children will gain those crucial life skills, as there is little or no provision from social services. Without this opportunity, their chances of coping with any sort of independent living in adulthood are seriously diminished." The council's executive member for education, Councillor Peter Edgar, was due to decide whether to launch a formal consultation yesterday afternoon, after the Chronicle went to press. A council spokesman said a package of support had been agreed in principle to meet two boarding children's needs and keep them in Osborne. The third is set to be transferred to adult services. Andover's Wolverdene School has 10 beds for children with social, emotional and mental health issues, SEMH, but these are separate to the needs met by Osborne. Mrs. O'Donnell declined to comment ahead of the consultation, which will run until February the 26th, if Councillor Edgar gives it the green light. A final decision is due on March the 18th. And there is a little photograph of the outside, or a part of the outside of Osborne School, and inset a small photograph of Sarah O'Donnell, the head teacher.
Now, this item comes under heading Falcons in Search for Home. And the article's accompanied by a photograph of a beautiful photograph of a falcon just taking off from a high building with its top blue feathers of the wings outstretched, black and white, speckled undercarriage, and legs hanging down, talons pointing downwards so it hasn't yet taken up its undercarriage. It's a lovely photograph. And also accompanying the photograph is an artist's impression of the development of the former police headquarters. Peregrine falcons have been moved from their nest on Hampshire's former police headquarters. Two of the fastest birds on the planet are circling the skies of Winchester to find a new home. Peregrine falcons have been moved from their nest on Hampshire's former police headquarters before it is demolished for housing. The 1960s tower block in Romsey Road has been netted over and is set to be pulled down over the summer. A small box for the falcons has been installed by Winchester University on its Burma Road halls of residence, but it's up to the birds whether they land there. I would say there's probably quite a small chance that the peregrines will choose to use it, maybe a 10% chance, said Keith Betton, county recorder at Hampshire Ornithological Society, which organised the work. I think it's much more likely they'll try to find a church or another building that works for them. Sometimes what they do is take a year out and don't nest. To nest out of the area and move into another area, they might be moving into another peregrine's territory. The police headquarters was decommissioned last year to make way for a proposed 200 housing house estate.
Ramblers swing into action with Gate. Winchester Ramblers have been busy improving access to the countryside, with Coldon Common Parish Council helped to replace two dilapidated stiles and replace them with metal gates to allow easy access on a parish path last Tuesday. The parish council paid for and supplied the gates, and the Winchester Rambler volunteers, under the supervision of John Foey, provided the manpower. Hampshire Countryside Service supplied the tools. The project started as a result of an ongoing survey work by Alan Marlowe, a member of Winchester Ramblers and Hampshire area representative. With council funding cuts, the voluntary efforts are crucial in keeping rural footpaths clear from growth. The Ramblers were pleased by the swift response of the parish council when alerted to the access problems. And pictured left to right on January the 12th is John Foey, Mike Moore, Paul Chinkin, Alan Marlowe and Matthew Lovering standing by a very smart new gate.
Hampshire actress Sarah Parrish has expressed her delight that local businesses are supporting her charity. Sarah, who co-founded the Murray Parish Trust in memory of her daughter to raise money for intensive childcare at Southampton Hospital, was at No. 5 Bridge Street Bar in Winchester with her husband James Murray. Ms. Parrish, star of several TV dramas including Mistresses, Cutting It and Atlantis, said, "We are delighted that Ideal Collection, New Forest Spring Water, Harvest Fine Foods and Hampshire Fair are collaborating to support the Murray Parish Trust. It's a relatively young charity and we are keen to involve the immediate community, so it's ideal that we have local producers and local businesses supporting our charity. At the launch was Tracy Nash from Hampshire Fair, Oliver Weeks, MD of Ideal Collection, the owners of No. 5 Bridge Street, James Murray and Sarah Parrish, Kevin Cowell, Director of New Forest Springwater, and Phil Clark of Harvest Fine Foods. And there is a very jolly photograph of the bar at No. 5 with Sarah, James Murray and Sarah Parrish with some of their supporters that I've just named, all with their hands on bottles which are probably spring water and other delights of a non-alcoholic nature, but all very pleased at the outcome.
MP lays date brick at new apartments for the elderly. Mearn Valley MP George Hollingberry laid the last brick of a new retirement home in Wickham. Wickham Court will provide 31 one- and two-bed flats for the elderly, with underfloor heating, oak veneered doors and high-spec kitchens. The McCarthy and Stone project has welcomed its first residents with nearly half the flats reserved off-plan. Mr. Hollingberry was given a tour of the site in Winchester Road by Eddie Norwood, senior site manager, before laying foundations for the official date brick. The platinum range retirement living apartments are served by a lounge, landscape gardens, 24-hour emergency call points, a secure entrance, its own manager, and a guest suite for friends and relatives. Kim Coldwell, Regional Sales and Marketing Director for McCarthy & Stone, said, "We were delighted that George Hollingberry MP was able to take time out and visit our exciting new Wickham Court development. And we look forward to welcoming retirees in and around Wickham to have a look at the superb range of facilities available." And there's a photograph of Mr. Hollingberry laying the date brick, 2015. Trowel in hand. And next to him are McCarthy and Stone assistant site managers Thomas Pierzonka and Eddie Norwood. Eddie Norwood there with a bucket of cement, providing the cement for the trowel, which lays the brick. All looking very happy, and a very good photograph there.
Pair to cross ocean for two charities. An Alsford man is rowing across one of the biggest oceans on Earth to raise money for an injured war veterans and people with a genetic disorder. Theo Jones of Broad Street is crossing the Atlantic with Shane Chadwick in a grueling two-month challenge. The 27-year-old, whose day job is operating million-pound yachts for royalty and high-flying business people, is using his expertise in a bid to raise £100,000 for two charities. The Not Forgotten Association provides recreation for wounded veterans, while Think Fragile X raises awareness of Fragile X syndrome, which causes intellectual and physical disabilities. More people have been into space and climbed Mount Everest than row the Atlantic, according to the organisers of the Talisker Whiskey Challenge. Theo and Shane's team HESCO is one of 30 taking part. They set off from Tenerife days before Christmas and are travelling thousands of miles non-stop, taking two-hour shifts on the oars. They hope to arrive in Antigua in time for Theo's birthday on February the 10th. His mother, Charmaine Jones, said he wanted to do it when he was 18, but at 18 we thought it was just not on. He was probably too immature then and had all the risk. Theo and Shane have been really good and ready for 18 months because apart from buying all the equipment and getting it up to scratch, they've had to get the training. Last week, the pair were set back around 14 miles as a major storm forced them backwards at around 30 knots or 34 miles per hour. At the time of writing, Theo and Shane are in the main pack behind two British front runners. Their progress can be tracked on a live map. And there's two lovely pictures. The first one is Theo Jones and Shane Chadwick on dry land, looking at towards the camera with their dog in the middle of them on Atlantic Voyager 2015, which is obviously their boat. And the other one is more dramatic, is Theo and Shane on a practice run on the sea. And my thoughts are rather them than me, really. It looked rather rough.
A Winchester fire engine was used in the likely suicide of a newlywed father, an inquest heard. Darren Harvey, aged 25, crashed head-on into the emergency vehicle in the New Forest last August, a hearing was told last week. The Winchester crew, unharmed in the crash, were thanked for their selflessness as they stopped traffic and ensured others were safe. Firefighter Sean Coote told the hearing the engine was returning from an emergency call in Lymington on August the 22nd, 7 weeks after Mr. Harvey's marriage. The coroner said it was probable the 25-year-old killed himself, but was not sure enough to record a verdict of suicide. Excuse me. Winchester Coroner's Court heard the mechanic of Portsmouth Road, Woolston, suffered from depression and had attempted to take his life in the past. All he would say was that he wasn't good enough for anyone. He was a bad dad. He was a bad fiancé. He was a bad mechanic. Everyone would be better off if he wasn't here, said his 22-year-old widow, Becky Harvey. After becoming upset on August the 22nd, Mr. Harvey phoned his father-in-law, asking him to look after Ms. Harvey before getting into his Ford Puma, the inquest heard. I was just screaming at him to open the door and he just looked at me. I thought he was going to go and kill himself. I stood in front of the car and locked the gates. He just drove me out of the way. And he just drove off. The crash occurred at around 10:55 p.m. on the A337 south of Lyndhurst. Footage from the fire engine's dashboard showed Mr. Harvey's Ford Puma moving to the centre of the unlit road before colliding with the engine, which veered right and into greenery on the other side. The car overturned and Mr. Harvey died instantly, the inquest heard. Crash investigator Michael Johnson said Mr. Harvey was not wearing a seatbelt when he struck the fire engine at an estimated 60 miles an hour. Recording a verdict of death due to road traffic collision, senior Central Hampshire chronicler Graham Short said, "I cannot believe that he did not see the lights on the fire engine. I therefore believe it is probable that this was a deliberate act." And there was a photograph of the notice at the crash scene on 337 asking for witnesses. And there is a picture of Darren Harvey and his wife Becky on their wedding day less than 2 months before his death, looking at that time quite happy and smiling. And a picture of the Winchester fire station where the engine was returning.
Mayor's home needs revamp. The ageing residence of the Mayor of Winchester needs a £250,000 revamp, a review of the building has concluded. Abbey House in the Broadway has structural issues which are affecting its use as an office and official home for Councillor Angela Clear. An informal scrutiny group at Winchester City Council has called on leaders to bring it up to minimum standard so it can be used for meetings.
City strengthens China collection. And I apologise if my pronunciation of the Chinese words are wrong. Winchester maintained its strong China connection as two delegations visited the city. The visits come as Winchester City Council announced it will be creating a new tourism web portal in Chinese. The first delegation, shortly before Christmas, came from Hubei province. It explored the links between culture and the economy, and the group fitted in an impromptu tour of Winchester Cathedral, following a presentation by the Reverend Canon Dr. Rowley Rhyme about the cathedral's history and the role in local cultural life. The second visit was of officials from Zhejiang province who found out how local government in the UK is harnessing IT to deliver services for residents. Winchester already has strong links with China through the School of Art, which has a collaborative enterprise in Dalian, one of China's most affluent regions, home to a large number of high-tech enterprises and China's long-established international fair for the fashion and textile industry. Both universities in Winchester reach out to overseas students, with growing numbers of Chinese enrolments reflecting the appeal of the city as a safe and attractive place with relevant modern courses. Head of Tourism Ellen Simpson said, "The number of tourists visiting the UK from China has more than doubled in the last few years, up from 89,000 in 2009 to 185,000 in 2014. Making the country one of the UK's fastest-growing tourism markets." Councillor James Byrne, portfolio holder for the local economy, said, "At the time when David Cameron and George Osborne are seeking to build links with China for long-term economic advantage, I am interested to see how we might explore this at a more local level." And there is a picture of the Mayor of Winchester, Councillor Angela Clear, with Chinese visitors outside the Abbey House. There's quite a lot of them, actually.
Thank you. That concludes the extracts for this week. So thank you to our editors, Sue Frain and Linda Vincent. And thanks to our copying, dispatch and memory stick preparation teams. And thanks, of course, to our readers, Norm York.
Bye.
Graham Cranmer.
Goodbye.
Albie Minns.
Bye.
And from me, Keith Vincent, goodbye and do have an enjoyable week. And when you finish with this week's recording, please put the memory stick back in the wallet and return it as soon as possible, placing the address label inside the wallet. Thank you.